When you enter a forest, the noise from different insects are reverberating in the air and filling your ears. And the heat also makes it feel like you're hearing your own blood flow in your ears. And it is an alienating experience walking through because you know you're not really welcomed in this place. So many life forms are long established in the very pathways that you're trying to walk along. And you really do feel like every step you're making is disturbing something that had already been there before you were. Everywhere you look down, you see life making new life on the dead leaves on the ground, and then you look up and you're surrounded by so much greenery. So this feeling of entering a space that is not your own is a very alienating feeling. As a person, you feel like a visitor in the site. And I also do think that orangutans who don't know this forest, I also wonder to what extent do they feel like they are alienated from the space. If you bring an orangutan into a forest that has never lived in a forest before, that has only lived in a cage, or has only lived, chained up somewhere, they're not going to know what to do. They will also need to learn how to inhabit the space. Semi-wild orangutans aren't actually acting out of nature. What they're able to act out is whatever that they have been able to learn under incredibly constrained circumstances. How we think about orangutan social lives is that they're often really singular units. They're really singular individuals wandering around, tolerating each other when circumstances allow them to, but otherwise spending a lot of time avoiding each other. So to enter the forest alone is almost like you're mirroring that orangutan social world, that you are entering a space cautiously, knowing that you're encroaching on somebody's space, that a space that is constantly visited upon by somebody else. I think that there's a different kind of orientation towards orangutans, that the fact of a human orangutan relationship is not meaning that they're all the same, because they're really not the same. And what I mean by that is that you can see this in the stance. Here, you have two creatures from totally different circumstances. One is terrestrial, the other one aerial, and here you have contact, you have a meeting between them. And yet, this isn't a point of domination or control. It's a space in which humans and orangutans face each other under circumstances that neither likely wishes, that neither is fully in control. And so you see this in a forest where you feel like you are a visitor, and the orangutan has to engage with the human who is visiting their space. That's not the case necessarily for wild orangutans, but certainly for semi-wild orangutans. Even the forest space that they have is a space that is also inhabited and used by people. So they encounter people under so many different circumstances, whether direct, like this, where a human is feeding an orangutan, or indirect, in in terms of the space that is carved out for orangutans is also carved out by human activities. So think about the roads that cut through the forest. Think about the plantations that encroach the forest. So yeah, the lives of semi-wild orangutans are very much shaped by human encounters, whether direct or indirect. And so knowing that, then I think it becomes this moral and ethical question for all of us, which is how do we want to inhabit our side of this interface? How do we want to inhabit this kind of relationship? Like, are we going to continue to be oblivious to the impact that we make on these orangutans' lives? Or can we imagine another way of relating to them that isn't about domination and forcing orangutans to either fulfill our aesthetic demands or forcing orangutans to just suffer under our desires for more plantations, more forests converted into wood and timber and paper and things like that? Yeah, orangutans, you know, and I think it's semi-wild orangutans in particular are really emblematic of what it is to live in this particular global moment, knowing that the impact on their lives is both profound and irreversible. And with any human impact, right, there's some who, like, I think it's important to not just say human impact. I think it's really important to make, you know, distinct explanations about what do we mean by human impact. And you know, it's not for me a story of poaching as much as it is a story about converting space into plantations and pushing orangutans under these circumstances where they need human intervention to live. And knowing that, okay, as soon as an orangutan has an encounter with a human, that they can't just go back to wild circumstances, because if they had an encounter with a human, it means that their habitat is shrinking. It means that they cannot return to their habitat. It does feel like the world of semi-wild orangutans is a story of urbanization, because orangutans are forced to be in constant contact with each other as if they were living in a city. You know, orangutans are only found in Sumatra and in Borneo. Part of that is that they were spread out throughout much of Asia and during the early Pleistocene, in the Miocene, just before the Pleistocene. And circumstances, namely climate change at that time during these different ice ages, pushed them towards Sumatra and Borneo, and then melting ice created the sea that's between Sumatra and Borneo. It was these kinds of environmental pressures at the time, and radically different environmental changes happening within a few thousands of years that push orangutans to develop a kind of social organization where they had a higher success rate at surviving if they were to be spread out as opposed to being concentrated. Their social organization is a much of a story about environmental change, actually. So, to imagine trying to fight thousands and thousands of years, and I suppose thousands of generations, trying to fight that within a lifetime, where orangutans are being pushed into city circumstances like this, or within like two generations or three generations, Yeah, that is a lot to ask. Among people who are of the ethnic group known as Iban in Sarawak and in the other side of the border, shared with Indonesia, there's this idea that orangutans can potentially be an ancestor, that they might be a Nyarong, which is like a spirit representation that takes animal form of an ancestor who is there to protect you. That's a Nyarong. Tua is simply elder or parent or a sense of an ancestor. And so there's a ritual prohibition against ever harming or killing a Nyarong of one's ancestor. When an Iban person encounters an orangutan, the feeling, the emotion that it evokes is a feeling called gili. And gili is something that I think the best translation for this word is a feeling of creepiness, a feeling that you're seeing something you're not supposed to be seeing, and a feeling that raises the hair at the nape of your neck, that there's something scary, but also titillating and wondrous, but definitely creepy and scary. That's the feeling that the children I lived with had when looking at an orangutan. There is something really disturbing when looking at an orangutan, and I don't think it's a feeling that you're seeing something like human, that you're seeing another primate. I don't think it's that at all. What I really do think is that there's something uncanny about encountering this being that isn't about sense of, oh, I recognize myself. That there's something else that demands recognition here. And I think that something else is something much more profound. And I think that's the sense that you are engaging with somebody that is truly otherworldly. And I don't think we really have the tools to understand that. Like, I don't think we have the capacities to really reckon with the idea that there are things on this earth that are much more disturbing and much more profound in their fact of being than what we're able to actually recognize.